I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course those of you who think that listening to the radio feels like thinking. Hey, good morning to you. How you doing, Mark Riley? I missed you yesterday.
Yeah, I missed you too, man. Welcome back.
Thank you. I want to thank all the listeners who emailed their excitement and concern that I wasn't going to be away too long. Thank you for missing me. I appreciate it.
And I heard
that.
Jerusalem Syndrome was a smash hit on the West Coast.
Dude, it far exceeded my expectations, my friend.
Really?
Yeah, well, that doesn't take much. Since I plow myself into the ground and bury myself with insecurity and put myself to the edge of sanity before I do anything. Every morning I go through this. That's what I'm doing up in the down in the office, trying to prepare for this show. Just sitting there going, God, do I want to kill myself? Or, now, you know what, one more day.
There you go.
No, but I got out there, and, I spent a lot of time rehearsing this thing in my apartment. And I got out, and I saw my wife, and we ran it. I hadn't even done the whole thing all the way through until the day of the show at home when I got to my house.
Okay.
And for some reason, dude, since the last time I did, and I've done this thing hundreds of times, I haven't done it in like 2 or 3 years, there was like a good crowd. Like Poway, I had no idea. Poway is not San Diego. It, you know, we get off the highway, we're driving to Poway, and, you know, I'm seeing, like, you know, horse farms and, you know, and there's no stores. And I'm like, you know what, we're in trouble. You know, I used to get that feeling when I was doing stand-up, and I do these one-nighters. You drive out, and all of a sudden it gets dark, and all you see is a church and some cows, and you're like, there's no way this gig's going to be good, you know. But it turns out Poway, not only is it an old sort of, you know, cowboy town, but it's a new sort of, you know, Sony just built their headquarters near there. It's a new tech town.
Oh, okay.
I have no, you know, I don't even know who was there, but about over 400 people came to the show.
Look out.
Which I thought was great, because you never know with subscription theaters, is it going to be 10 people in a huge theater? But a lot of people came out. A lot of Morning Sedition fans came out.
Excellent.
A woman came up to me after the show wearing a shirt with Mark and Mark on it. She gets up at 3 in the morning there to listen to us, and she doesn't have to get up until 6. And she gets up. I wish I'd gotten her name. Thank you for coming to the show.
And she's up now, then.
She's up now listening to us. Fabulous. And the woman who works in the box office theater, big Mark Riley fan, big Mark Maron fan, big Air America fan, knows all the people. They talk to me like it's sort of like, so Al was saying that you guys, I'm like, I don't know. You know, did Randy ever get that thing? I don't know.
Yeah, right?
You know, they listen to us, you know, fairly.
Engaged listeners.
Yes, I have to get them a picture. But the show itself, because I had some distance and I wasn't the neurotic mess that is in the show. And, you know, when I wrote the show, I was that guy for the most part, and now, like, since I've evolved to a certain degree or grown up or whatever, there was a distance there, so I was able to, like, act it. So me acting like me then was actually funnier than me being that guy then.
I got a question.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Did you run this whole thing in front of your wife before? Did you rehearse in front of your wife before you went up?
Of course.
The whole thing?
Yes.
Wow, that's good. That takes guts to do that in front of one person.
Oh, well, it's the only way you can do it. You know, but I'm just so glad I did the homework. I mean, that's something no matter how much I dreaded it, you know, the last month, you know, going home after the show, being exhausted, just saying, I got to do it. I got to plow through this. I got to know this stuff. Because you don't want to be a week before going, oh, man. I used to do that in school all the time. But did you have a nice, by the way, Kalo, you lost. All right, you lost. I did not eat meat.
I find that hard to believe.
Why would I lie to you? But you know what? I do realize. I called Kalo from the airport on Friday. I called him from the airport. Dude,
the gods were on my side, my friend.
I bet Kalo bet me $20 that I would eat meat before. The time when I went to see my wife, he was sure that I would buckle and eat meat. Mm-hmm. So I've been a vegetarian or a pescatarian, whatever you want to call it. I'm not, you know, tooting my own horn here. I'm not doing this because it's not out of my love for animals, or I think it might be healthier, so I'm trying it. That's basically where I'm at with that. I love animals, but there's something nasty about meat. You know, that's all I'm saying. Chicken doesn't taste like chicken, and I think that the meat source, that the entire meat industry is corrupt and creepy and it's full of bugs and bacteria. That's my belief. But here's what I'm saying to you. I call up Kalo. I didn't realize. See, I think I don't eat much meat until you don't realize how much meat you eat until you have to stifle the desire. I call Caleb from the airport. I'm at JetBlue. It's their birthday. It's JetBlue's birthday. There's people there's people walking around with cupcakes. They're giving out things. There's free popcorn. And there's a hot dog cart. And I'm not even thinking. I'm like, wow, you know, I just got done with the show. I'm going to L.A. And I'm like, I didn't eat. You know, I'm going to grab a dog. So I'm online. Riley. I got the dog in my hand.
Oh, with dog in hand?
Yeah, I'm looking at the guy. And I'm like, oh, no. I got to throw this away. Anyway, so I had a guy, I threw the dog away, two cupcakes, called Caleb up. Now, how is that a good thing? Like, here, I don't want to eat meat because it's unhealthy. I'm going to stuff two cupcakes into my face. So I called Caleb up, and I'm like, oh, man, it was close, man. I had the dog in my hand.
You wasted food. Oh. How dare you?
Oh.
What a big bad liberal.
I see what you're saying.
Chris, have you forked over yet?
I see what you're saying.
It's in my hands, Riley.
Oh, there it is.
$20
the big 20, the big 2-0.
And Dig, my wife, who's like sensitive to my plight, supposed to be supportive, right? We're going out for it's Valentine's Day. She decides, thank God she did that, we were going to cook dinner at home. We had to do ours on Sunday. So we're in Whole Foods. I figure we'll get the good stuff. I'm thinking I'm going to get some fish. She's thinking like lamb chops. I'm like, cool. So we're in the store, and we're at the meet, you know, and she looks at me, she goes, sometimes they do things, the women, that just baffle me. She goes, you know, would you mind too bad if I had a porterhouse? I'm like, are you kidding me? You decided on lamb chops. So I could have, like, because that's the food, when I was eating the meat, we'd go out and get porterhouse steaks, you know, I told you about it.
Yeah.
Right? So she's like, you wouldn't mind too bad. I'm like, what's wrong with you? Wait, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, I mean, isn't it enough that you're smoking in front of me all the time? Like, you want, get a porterhouse. You know what? You know, just eat the porterhouse in front of me. Why don't you get a few different kinds of things and not finish them? Maybe some hamburger, get some lamb chops. So, no, but she ended up getting these big old lamb chops, which was, it didn't bother me.
The lamb chops didn't bother you, but the porterhouse would have bothered you.
Yeah, because we eat the porterhouse together. It's a nice thing. Did you have a nice Valentine's Day?
I had a lovely Valentine's
Day. A lot of pressure for people, Valentine's Day. It's a crazy holiday.
Yeah, but you know what? You walk around a little bit, you find a little of this, you find a little of that, and everything is okay.
There's a lot of pressure to, you know, to show up and do the right thing that night. You know what I mean? It's a very sad thing to have the disappointing sex on Valentine's Day. You know what I mean? It's sort of a sad thing to wake up and it's like, hey, sorry. Happy Valentine's Day.
It'll be all right.
Man, doesn't it feel good to be back? Doesn't it feel good to get this show back to that level? Yes. Hey, thank you for the card, the very lovely card. We've got some cards today. Happy Valentine's Day. And it's got a little kitty cat on it, Riley. And the kitty cat—it's the kitty cat saying, "Is somebody chopping onions in here?" The Mortensen.
Yeah.
Mark, and everybody and everyone at Morning Sedition. I think it says Catherine in Brooklyn, and on the front, somebody chopping onions. She loves that line. She actually cut out a picture of someone chopping onions and put that on the front.
Wow.
And I got somebody.
You got to show that to Mort.
Yeah, I will absolutely show that to Mort. I'll probably start weeping. And then somebody sent me this old book. This woman who has written us some emails, she's, you know, I don't want to, she's nice, all right, this is Lynn, and she sent me a How to Talk to Your Cat book, you know, with a letter, and, you know, and I'm not going to get into this letter. It was one of these things like, here's a book, and here's some more criticism, you know what I mean, like, here's the present, do you like that? Good, well, here's some things that are wrong with what you do. But no, I appreciate that, and I'm not going to get into the letter because it'll probably take us into a place where I don't need to go right now in terms of topics, because I do want to get into the news. I'm very excited. I'm sorry I missed yesterday because I was thrilled with Howard Dean's speech. In his acceptance speech, I was thrilled at his, you know, sort of just right out in the open, right away, locks in to taking fiscal responsibility, which I think is by and large, at least in my lifetime, been a Republican frame.
Yes.
And he's going to take it. And he's thrown us some bait here, Riley. I think what he's saying is, look, this is where they're vulnerable. This is what we got to hit. They're sucking the money dry. They're bankrupting the country. They've overextended, you know, everything. To the point where, you know, this country is going to be not only broke, but in the hole for God knows how long. And they're taking our money, and they're taking your money, and this is what we have to take them to task on.
That's a very, very smart move on the part of Howard Dean, because it's something certainly that the congressional leadership, the congressional Democratic leadership, can get behind very easily. And they need to find common cause, because, you know, some of the opposition to Howard Dean's ascendancy here had to do with people in Congress who didn't want to see him become DNC chair. He's too far left. He's too far left. So this fiscal responsibility thing is something they can easily latch on to.
The left thing is a Republican idea. This and whoever within the Democratic Party said that about Dean, it's just a lie. You know, Dean is just a guy that's willing to stand up for something. He's not a leftist. You know, he's a Democrat to the core, and he has core Democratic values. We're going to talk about that later in the show, because there's a new democracy in Iraq that is starting to look a lot like a theocracy. It's the neocon death cult's very own talent. Taliban. Even though the last one was there too, they got a new one. We'll talk about how that's you know, falling into place or out of place or, you know, whatever it is. It's 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
This is Congressman Barney Frank, and you're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Did you?
Twenty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
On Morning Sedition. That's right. I'm back. Sorry, grown-ups. Hey, so let's talk about this, Riley, because it seems to me, from my understanding, from my limited ability to wrap my brain around this thing, that Sistani's Shiite party did not take a majority of the votes, which is good in some respects, because in most respects, because it will allow a little more debate. But he is aligning himself with the Kurds. My question is, after you flesh all this out, is essentially, what do we got here? I mean, is this an Iraq that's going to align itself with Iran eventually? Is this an Iraq that's going to be like, you know, open every assembly with like, down with Israel? I mean, did we bring stability, or did we, what is really happening? What does it look like?
The $64,000 number of questions are the ones that you just asked. And interestingly enough, I'm not sure there are any people in the Bush administration that know the answers.
Yeah.
What we have is the United Iraqi Alliance as the big winners here.
Right.
Even though at first they're saying, well, they only got 48% of the vote. They're using a quota system called Air Quota. And under that system, they will likely wind up, if you listen to Juan Cole, who's an expert on Iraqi affairs from the University of Michigan, he says they're going to end up with somewhere between 51 and 53% of the vote. That's significant because it breaks that 50% threshold. Right now, most of the media is saying they've got 48%.
Okay.
Now, either way, the Kurds finished second. They've got 26%. Anywhere from 24 to 26, depending on who you talk to.
Right, the Kurdistan Alliance.
The Kurdistan Alliance. Now, of course, the Kurds have their own agenda here. Independence would seem to be the end game. At the very least, an autonomous federal republic within Iraq is acceptable, apparently, to this group. Right now, the Shia and the Kurds are negotiating, because you combine those two votes and you've got the two-thirds majority needed to push through a new Iraqi constitution. Now, the constitution is important in terms of how it deals with Islamic law, and we talked about that last week.
And the Kurds will be aligning with themselves with whatever political faction is going to give them the most autonomy, I imagine.
That's the subject of the negotiations with the UIA. It is, in fact, only the UIA that they can unite with that will give them enough seats on the assembly to push through whatever it is they want and have it codified in the constitution.
Okay.
Alawi's group was number three in the voting. They only got about 14% of the vote, so they were,
and they had to beat people up for 6% of those 14.
14, yeah. So on that level, I guess you could call Alawi a big loser in all of this. And what's interesting about that is we were told, Mark, by two different correspondents in Baghdad that Alawi was done.
Yeah,
and this is before the election.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, the Iraqi List, which was his organization, got 14% of the vote, good for 40 seats.
Here's how he campaigned. Who are you voting for?
I was thinking maybe the, you know, al-Sistani. I don't know. Maybe I'm not sure. I was thinking maybe al-Sistani. I vote for you.
There you go. That's how it works.
That's the Alawi campaign.
Now, you know, another big loser here was the interim Iraqi president, Ghazi al-Yawar. His party, only got five seats,
uh-huh.
about 150,000 votes. And, of course, all the votes are not yet completely counted. This is according to a count yesterday.
That's weird because neither are the ones in Ohio.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I'm not sure.
Good, good following good, right?
Uh-huh.
So another set of big losers here. Are the two Sunni Muslim groups that urged a boycott of the elections, the Association of Islamic Scholars and the Iraqi Islamic Party. Both boycotted the election. None of them won any seats whatsoever, but they do want a role in helping to draft the Constitution so that they don't end up being an oppressed minority inside of Iraq. And, of course, depending on who you listen to in the American government, it is the Sunnis that are at the heart of the insurgency against both the U.S. and the interim Iraqi government.
Primarily ex-Baathist in collusion with jihadists,
yes.
who are sort of, you know, helping each other, but not necessarily on the same page.
Not necessarily on the same page.
Now, I don't understand, Mark. Explain to me how a group says, I'm not going to be part of this process, and then says, but I want in afterwards. I mean, what? I don't understand that tactic.
Well, ironically enough, the Sunnis aren't the only ones that are doing it. Al-Sadr, Muqtada al-Sadr, you know, the radical Shiite cleric, also urged his people to boycott the elections. He didn't think the elections would be valid. He wanted the U.S. troops removed before there were any elections.
So, okay.
Yet
so
now he still wants in also.
Okay, so the tactic is basically, you know, screw you, all right, but we're big enough that you got to reckon with us. We're
yeah.
not going to play your little game, but we have enough power and enough influence that where's our peace now?
Yeah.
Because you can't, what are you going to do, just leave us out here to hang to dry? You're going to pay for that.
But see, the United Iraqi Alliance seems to be prepared to include these different groups. They have no, you know, now, granted, al-Sadr was critical of Sistani's push for elections, but Sistani's people are saying, look, we can include them, and they're also saying we can include the Sunnis, and the Sunnis seem to be making some nice gestures toward the Shia at the same time.
Well, maybe Sistani will make al-Sadr his Karl Rove. Maybe maybe this is the way the cabinet is going to fill out over there. It's fascinating to me because let's be clear that not only are we there under false pretenses in Iraq, but you know not only were we not there to do what we've done there, which is create enough chaos. And enough problems, and then say, but we're bringing democracy. Okay, so now they have a vote. Now we have a theocratic government taking root a little bit.
But see that's the interesting part. The UIA is saying they want a government based on Islamic law, but they don't want a theocracy. And it's a very, very thin line they're parsing here. They're saying they don't want a theocracy similar to Iran's, but they do want a country that is governed by Islamic law. We'll get into that a little bit.
Yeah, and
further.
Maybe the balance will be in Chalabi. Remember the Iranian spy and the guy who lied to us to get us to start bombing the country in the first place? It looks like he might be the buffer. Yeah, when we come
he's
back, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, he's got his fingers in the pie. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here. Mark Riley sitting right over there.
Hey.
You're listening to Morning Edition, a quick email. I'm so glad to have stumbled upon you two, humorous scholars as you are. As an ex-unemployed Silicon Valley exec now working for the military-industrial complex, I need the balance in life listening to Air America and especially Morning Edition. Keep up the good fight. That's RF in Boulder. You bet. We're doing what we can. And to begin that fight right now, we've got a guy on the inside who came here in a dress. Ramon was wearing a dress with Laura Bush's Palm Pilots. Here's Laura Bush's Palm Pilot for today because she's taking a more active role during his second term with the anti-gang stuff and whatnot. 8 a.m., wake up, assume human form. 10 a.m., quietly return George's Valentine's Day gift. Note, there's just too many zippers and buckles and fake fur. 11 a.m., clean up after last night's black tie Valentine's Day dinner. Note, find industrial grease cutter to soak up large oily spot on Karl Rove's chair. Because, when you're, an alien, you leave that mess. 1 p.m., find new chef. Someone who can cook Southern, but without that nasty Clinton aftertaste. 3 p.m., meet with the anti-gang task force. Note, insist that they call me OGOP. then laugh and ask if anyone needs more finger sandwiches. 5 p.m., meet with new social secretary. See if she can raise our social standing in Washington from loathed to shunned. Shunned. 8 p.m., make sure George isn't looking, then read something. Anything, a cereal box, a laundry list, just as long as there are words. Note, I won't let him starve my mind. I won't. Hi, I'm Iyad Alawi. Did you vote for me? Did you? Did you? Just say you did. Come on, say it. So tell me, Mark Riley, as we parse the Iraq situation, the Kurds and the Shiite,
Iraqi Alliance. That's the largest umbrella group of Shiite candidates. They had the big list. They won 140 to 141 seats National Assembly.
Let me just get this straight. So we backed Iraq in a war against Iran. All right, so now Iran and Iraq are going to be ideologically connected at the hip, not just connected at the border, connected at the mind, at least in what is going to unfold as in maybe a more moderate Sharia-based regime, but certainly a Muslim-based law regime. So what happens now? Is America just the big stumbling doofus, and they've opened this can of worms, and now what we're going to have is maybe they're looking for some consolidated enemy. Maybe they're looking for an Iraq. That Iraq is the new country that might become our enemy in 15 years.
Well, see, that is entirely possible. It's funny you mentioned that because I was thinking about that earlier today. What happens if they just dissolve the border and decide to make it one super nation in the Middle East? That's not likely to happen, but there are two names, Mark, that I think our listeners ought to know about. That they've heard of al-Sadr, they've heard of Alawi, they've heard of Shalabi, they've heard of Sistani, they've heard of all these different people. Two names they need to know. One is Abdul Aziz al-Hakim. He is the leader of the winning party, the UIA, the United Iraqi Alliance. The other name is Jalal Talabani. He's head of the Kurdish organization that finished with 26% of the vote, which I believe was called the Kurdistan Alliance.
And then, it's interesting to me. Okay, first of all, there's a few other parties that were on the docket. Would you call it a docket or a ticket or a ballot?
On the ballot, yeah.
The other names a lot of people, there's so many names. There's a Communist Party, there are many names, but there's also Iraqis United in telling the Americans what they want to hear until they go away party. There's also the Islamic Anti-Party Party. There's the Terrified Minority, which didn't, not a big turnout for the Terrified Minority. Fundamentalists United to Blow Up Retarded Children, a.k.a. the Freedom Fighter Party, ooh, of course. Now, she's going to be mad.
Yes.
Isn't she?
Yes. No doubt about it.
And now she's going to, send me my cat book back. Lynn sent me a cat book, and she had a big problem with both my use of the word retarded and not willing to call them freedom fighters. There's the Coalition of the Unwilling Party, the Alliance to Stop the Sewers from Backing Up, which a lot of them all agree on, but only a few really represented it. The Lindy England Party, very small, very, very small, self-hating bunch. The soon-to-be extremely violent Iraqi Youth Party, that may be part of the insurgency, and the God is Screaming Inside My Head Party, which is, again, many people over there, but only a few in that party. Now, here's the Iranian connection, is that, so you've got these non-secular Iranian clergy that are really behind the momentum of these parties, and then you've got this Iranian pandering. He's not Iranian, but he certainly has been accused of being a spy.
You're talking about Shalabi.
The secular face of the slimy politics of the region. He completely mirrors, the type of politicians we have here. One thing you got to say about Shalabi is that as big of a slime dog as he is, he's very effective, and he's willing to pander to anybody that will, give him what he wants and reach his own goals, not unlike many of the politicians here.
Well, for people who don't remember what Shalabi's situation was, this was Bush's guy for the longest time. And then suddenly, at a point when there started to be some reports circulating that he was passing information from Iraq to Iran, suddenly he became persona non grata among the members of the Bush administration.
This is the guy that they chose to take his word over the CIA's. This is the guy that said, this is, like, the whole thing was a fix. This guy was a shill. This guy was a paid off. He was on the payroll of the CIA, of this government, a neocon death cult, knew that he was full of crap. All right, took his information anyways because he was a guy that had some standing there. He was a guy that said they had WMDs.
Yes.
He was a guy that sent us on this, not sent, I'm tired of using the collective we again. That sent the neocon death cult, that validated their agenda. I'm not even going to say sent. This was all planned. This was rigged from the beginning. But he was their guy. He was their shill. And once the crap started to hit the fan over there, they turned on him and said he was an Iranian spy, which he probably was, but they probably knew that too. This guy's a wheeler dealer. He's up for, he's been accused of embezzling $30 million in Jordan. I mean, this guy is a scumbag of the utmost degree. And he'd been doing business with the neocon death cult from the beginning. Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Faith. Fight, I mean, these guys used this guy, and he was their point guy, and now he's getting his pay. Because you know what these guys count on more than anything else? The neocon death cult and Karl Rove count on a collective short memory of the United States of America's, you know, citizens, because we're selfish, iPod-wearing religious fanatics, who, you know, and I distinguish between those two. I mean, as opposed to what they have on their iPod anyways. The iPod and the religious fanaticism serve similar purposes, but that's a broader argument that I might cover in Symphony Space on Thursday. But nonetheless... What they are really banking on is that we will forget, we will not care, it ultimately doesn't matter. The Iraq War was about democracy, it wasn't about WMDs anyways. So this guy who gave us information that we paid to give us information, he doesn't matter anymore. Now he might be the prime minister.
Yeah, he's lobbying to become the prime minister. Now, he's got some opposition. He's not the only one in line, but it is entirely possible that Chalabi, who had been so thoroughly discredited that the Americans raided his house, for God's sake.
But that is exactly like, you know, like Rumsfeld. Okay, that's exactly like Rumsfeld. He and Rumsfeld are almost a similar sort of position. No one has been more discredited and more accused of more heinous things than Donald Rumsfeld, yet that guy's still in power. This is the exact same type of politician, Chalabi.
Oh, yeah, and it looks as though at this point, when you start looking at who is who will actually take seats in this National Assembly, even if he doesn't end up being prime minister, there still may be a senior government post in line for Ahmed Chalabi.
At least some money. God knows there's billions of dollars missing over there. I'm sure he's got some of it in his pocket.
Well, either that or in an offshore bank account somewhere.
Who the hell knows? This guy's dirty, and so is the neocon death cult, and this whole war is a lie. Now we're supposed to jump up and down because these people have figured out how to vote because we're there with guns to their heads? It's ridiculous.
The interesting part about this, though, Mark, is that this guy, Talabani.
I was Malloying. Yeah.
The Kurd guy. He's very close to Iran.
Yeah.
And that was an X factor. You know, a lot of people in this country have been looking at the relationship between the Shia in Iraq and the Shia in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really has taken a close look at the relationship between the Shia in Iran and the Kurds in Iraq. Talabani is very friendly to the Iranians, which means something in terms of if he ends up being president.
Yeah.
And the United States decides to pursue anything against Iran, sanctions, targeted bombing or whatever. How do you think he's going to react to that as head of the country?
Yeah.
He is going to react very badly. Before, you go back 5 years, and if the United States had attacked Iran for any reason, the Iraqis would have cheered. Mm. Saddam would have cheered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've got a very different landscape over there. It's a landscape that the folks you call the neocon death cult had no idea would take place. They're looking at trying to balance, you know, the Saudis and the big oil producing states, Qatar and the rest of these places that are American allies. They figured that the Iraqis would join that group. Now it's possible that there could be an Iran-Iraq alliance that would control a huge chunk of oil similar to what the Saudis and the other Gulf states control, and that means a whole different ball game for the Americans.
Well, we're going to see some of that pretty quickly, I assume, since we're pressuring Iran to give up their nuclear secrets or to show their hand on a nuclear level. I mean, we're seeing satellite pictures of the supposed, you know, nuclear plants in Iran, and ironically, I think the same satellite picture showed up on CNN as being North Korea. It doesn't matter. You know, they're it's from a long way away. They all look similar. Who's going to question it? I mean, loud and loud. Who'd you vote for? I voted for Sistani. I'm sorry. God.
Whoops.
So we'll be back with more Iraq. It's 44 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks. having...
Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
Morning Sedition is the program you're listening to on Air America Radio. That's right. The facts, the funny, the fury. Morning Sedition. Don't be stupid. Hey, come on, man. Air America. It feels like thinking. All right. Here we go. Come on, man. I'm glad to be back. I was on Sunday night. I'm at home in Highland Park, and I'm like, I'm reading, the, you know, I'm like getting ready for work. I'm getting ready for work in California. All right, here we go. Here's the liberal agenda for today from the Streisand compound. One, criticize the Gates art installation in Central Park. Couldn't those hundreds of orange banners have been rainbow flags? I mean, come on. How about a little point? Where's the point? Two, new bumper stickers. Dated Dean, married Carrie, divorced Carrie, dating Dean again. Three, for the Westminster Dog Show, protest the designation best in show. Suggest they replace with, they're all good dogs. Four, praise Kanye West for winning 3 Grammys. Note, find out who Kanye West is. Okay, five, today's phrase is disrupting the conversation. Gee, I'm glad we didn't go through a bloody, expensive war just so we could replace Saddam with some militant pro-Iranian Shiites, man. I'm glad we didn't do anything like that. Incredibly stupid. Wake up, sheeple. You drank the Kool-Aid. Oh, the Westminster Dog Show brings you back. I got memories, Riley. I got memories I can't even go into. They're too dark. They're too weird.
What's up with the dog show?
Dude, my dad had a champion dog. I grew up with like 4 or 5 old English sheepdogs. I was covered in hair for most of my childhood. Right? And it was all about my dad's little hobby of showing dogs. So there was this chunk of my life when I was like 8 or 9 where I was being dragged to dog shows. And there was always dog poop around. There was hair everywhere. I had to deal with dog show people and wandering around dog shows and learning the different breeds. And oh my God. 5 in my lifetime, old English sheepdogs.
5 sheepdogs.
Covered in hair.
What kind of people are dog people? Tell me about that.
Well, they're all committed to their own dogs. Didn't you see that? What was that movie? The Best of Show? Those are dog people. I mean, they were a little over the top with it, but, you know, the people are very specific. They like, if they're into whatever dog they're into, they've got hats that say that dog. They've got shirts that say that dog. They like that specific type of dog. They're all about that dog. They got that dog on their license plate. They got special things that you only accommodate those dogs. And they look a little like the dogs that they have, except Old Englishes are, you know, stunning dogs. And, you know, but I think that's part of my cat thing, is that, like, I have a resentment against
dogs.
Because we had these Old English sheepdogs, and I loved them all of them. Mac, Raglan, Samantha, Disco. I liked them all.
You remember all their names. See, that's deep.
There's only 4. Then my mother's got these other 3 that she collected. You know, she's got these little Benji-looking dogs, these mutts that she collects, Giggles and Chuckles and, you know, whatever.
I always liked collies. Collies were always my favorite dog.
Yeah, I'm
but they're hairy though. They're like Lassie. Lassie was a collie.
Yeah, those are great dogs.
Yeah, they seem to be pretty smart.
Let's try to do the awkward segue from dog shows to the Iraqi assembly. Can we do that?
Oh yeah,
the awkward to say.
No, dog show to another.
No. Yeah, no, I don't think so. Iraq. That'll be the new country. Iraq. Okay.
The merger between now, mind you, Iran has about 70 million people. Iraq has about 25, 26. So you'd be talking about a very large state in the Middle East.
Yes.
As it stands now, Iran by itself is the largest state in the Middle East, population-wise, that is.
I just wish I understood what the hell they're thinking about doing now, the neocon death cult. I would see, it's always my assumption that they knew that this was a possibility. I'm always the guy that's so paranoid that thinks that even when things get as bad as they can possibly get, they somehow planned it because they're that evil and they're that, you know, they're that one step ahead of the game. And that's a part of the way that they've brainwashed me. You know, I believe that they've got, you know, that right now they're listening to me and they're making notes. I walk out of my apartment every day, Riley, half expecting a representative from the neocon death cult to be there with some sort of formality, like they're going to put that, what's that stuff where they knock you out? Yeah, they're going to etherize me and drag me to a bunker somewhere just to fill my brain up with something. Again, I just saw the Manchurian candidate. So anyways, What I'm asking you is, what's to stop this from happening? I mean, it seems to me that we're in the neocon death cults, is in a very precarious situation. And how does that parse out?
Well, they are in a precarious situation because this is not what they plan to have happen, even though everyone told them this is what would happen. The United Iraqi Alliance has maintained their position that they don't want to install an Iranian-type theocracy.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you've had Condoleezza Rice just recently, calling a group of unelected mullahs, talking about Iran, of course,
yeah,
and talking about, they're a rogue state. This is the whole nuclear thing,
right?
Which is a very, very dangerous proposition. Apparently, they have weaponry, or at least the United States is alleging they have access to weaponry that could travel about 1,500 miles, which would be a very dangerous thing,
yeah,
if they had that kind of delivery system. That means that the United States has no interest in an Iran-Iraq alliance. But that seems to be precisely what's taking place because you have the two major parties that won these recent elections, the UIA and the Kurdistan Alliance, both with good and deep ties to the Iranian government, even if they don't want to follow them and follow their template as far as the kind of government that they install.
Well, I guess the next phase, and I'm just theorizing as somebody who doesn't know much in terms of this kind of stuff, is that, now that they've had this military occupation where we are, relatively illegally occupying their countries, now because the infrastructure has faded so badly and is so destroyed and completely out of control, that whatever government is in place is going to be forced into a position of reliance upon, American companies or international companies to rebuild that infrastructure, which from all reports hasn't been done. I've read reports that Monsanto has got a hold on the farming economy, that they were at the behest of American military, and now they're going to be at the coerced behest of American corporate entities. So I guess it's going to be some sort of unholy alliance in the sense that, okay, if you want to play games and align yourself with Iran, well, you know what? Then we're not going to facilitate the building of this infrastructure. We're not going to give you what you need.
No. And see, the interesting part about that is that the Iraqis believe they can rebuild the infrastructure without the help of the Americans, that they can do it on their own. If they had control of their own oil, which is certainly, their ticket to wealth at this point, they would be able to rebuild this infrastructure. But listen to what Ram Khoury, who's an Arab analyst, he's the editor of Beirut's Daily Star, talking about your very same neocon death cult. The idea, and this is a quote, the idea that the United States will get a quick, stable, prosperous, pro-American and pro-Israel Iraq has not happened. Most of the neoconservative assumptions about what would happen have proven false.
Blah, 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 blah.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
We're looking now at a group of people who have, again, and see, this is the amazing part, Mark, they've been exposed like this before, and nothing's happened to them. They're still occupying positions of power in this administration.
That's because people are like, wait, hold on, I got my iPod, I just finished programming it, it's taken me 3 weeks. But don't you understand, they're lying. Who is? Look at, I got this playlist. It's 3 hours long. This is amazing. I'm going to go to the dog show.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to go there. Look at the dog. Oh, nice doggy. No, it's I'm friends. Friends. Be nice.
Yeah, right?
My name's Alawi. Please, who'd you vote for? What?
When we come back in the next hour of Morning Tradition, we're going to talk about some other religious situations going on right here in America, about Bible classes, faith-based initiatives, and more. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition on Air America Radio.
Gotta have.
Why not? Why not a little bit of that? Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, my favorites. And, of course, all of you feel like you're thinking right now. Right now, I'm thinking. That's all I do, Riley, is I think and I think and I think more.
Good
morning,
good.
Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's all right. I'll tell you something, man. I got to go down and see those gates. I missed the grand unfurling of the gates in Central Park.
I saw a picture on TV.
It's like, how many 100,000 people showed up to that?
To see the gates.
To walk through the gates, I guess.
To walk through the curtains.
Yeah.
Like, oh, look, there's another one. Then another one. And, oh, it's another one. And, oh, it's another one.
Christo and Jean-Claude.
There's so many of them.
Yeah.
I saw them setting up. I think. What's the matter, Kayla?
What are the gates?
The gates in Central Park, the big artistic installation by Christo and Jean-Claude, his woman friend, who did the running fence. Now, when they did the running fence, I was in like seventh grade. I mean, that's a long time ago. They did a running fence, this huge, it must be like 40 feet high, this curtain that just went, I think it was all across the French countryside. I'm not sure what country it was in. That's how stupid I am. But I remember seeing a documentary of it at the Art Theater in New Mexico about it. He's one of these guys that just gets these big ideas and he does them.
Well, you know when he first came up with the idea of doing the gates in Central Park?
When?
1979.
And he's hung on to it. And you know,
yes.
It's one of those ideas where you can't go, well, what's driving you? You know, it's sort of like, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's art for art's sake to a certain degree. It has a sort of a flow to it, obviously, and there's something lyrical and beautiful about seeing that number of curtains at that color and that sort of synchronized in that space together. It's one of those things where if you look at it just the right way, you're like, what is it? That's ridiculous. But if you look at it just the other way, you're like, that's beautiful. It's one of those things that is you just have to appreciate it for the visual poetry that it is, and I'm going to go check it out. People seem pretty fascinated with it. I was out of town when they pulled it up. Again, maybe I'm going to try to go to the dog show just to bring back horrible memories of my own life. And I'll tell you another thing, Riley.
You're going to torture yourself like that, are you?
Well, you know, I don't know. You know, my cats are like, I like cats, and I got to learn how. This woman sent, this very nice woman who sent me this, Lynn, who's a fan of our show and also a critic of mine, sent me a book, How to Talk to Your Cat. It's an old book, and it looks very funny. I think she did it with a slight tongue-in-cheek. But, you know, coincidentally, I'm having some problems with my cat talking to me, and I don't know what it wants. I'm serious, right? I got the three cats. I get up in the middle of the night. I feed them, and this one, who doesn't want me pet it, is still like,
want something else.
Well, I don't know what she wants. I know she wants love, but I can't. She doesn't let me touch her, so it's very delicate to negotiate this. Maybe the book will help. But Lynn did go. She sent me the nice book and a nice little note that, like, it was one of these notes where I'm reading. I'm like, wait, this is mean a little. Not mean, but she's like, here's your gift, and here's why you're wrong. Oh, my God.
But wait a minute. You know, there's something weird about that. Yeah. That's How to Talk to Your Cat, but what's on the cover of the letter?
Dogs. Yeah,
she
said, I'm not really a dog person, but I'm reaching out with this. She's basically, I'm not going to read the letter, but it's a nice letter. Apparently she likes boxers.
I
believe those are boxers, aren't they?
Those are boxers.
So, okay, well, here we go. Moving on. a few of my loves. I'm very happy to be back, by the way. It's very nice.
Well, it's good to have you back.
You would not have been able to deal with this flight that I was on going out, man. The turbulence was mind-bending, dude.
Like turbulence.
I fly so much, I can't afford to drain myself with the unnecessary fear of dying on a plane. I just can't do it, all right? It's just too much. I know. It's too much for me to picture. I picture it, but I'm just sort of like, okay, if that's the way this is going to happen, it's going to be an awful 30 seconds, okay? But I'm on this plane, and the guy's like, you know, when he's like, we're going to ask the flight attendant to sit down for a little while and discontinue drink service because of the turbulence. Like, oh, my God, this is going to be awful.
Yeah.
You know, so then this plane starts rocking, dude. And there's just a cutoff to where I can tolerate that. You know what I mean? There's a limit to my acceptance of the situation where I'm just sitting there going, okay, man, this is okay. These things are built to deal with this. I'm cool. And then it's like, wow, I'm getting queasy. And then after about an hour, I'm like, what is going on? Because I can only assume, this is where my brain goes. See, anytime the plane starts shaking like that, I assume that the guys in the cockpit are sitting there going, wow, we're in trouble. I don't know, you know, like, there's a couple of guys just sitting there sweating going, I don't know if we're going to make it through this, you know. That's what I think, you know. And then I start looking around, I'm like, oh, and then on the way back, there was some guy who stopped on you got to walk outside to get on a JetBlue. And some guy, he looked suspicious to me because he was tweaky. And he kept looking at me, and he stopped walking onto the plane to check in his pockets. I'm like, hey, he's the guy to keep your eye on.
And this is in LAX?
Oh, yeah, but then that's a whole other thing. Then I start looking like, okay, if that guy's going to be a problem, I start, like, assigning jobs to people on the plane. Like, well, that guy looks like he can take care of it. Like, if there's going to be a problem, that dude with the pecs and the forearm, he's not going to let anything happen. You know, I'm going to let him take care of it. And if I have to step in, I'll step in.
Now, did the TSA people notice his suspicious movements?
I don't know. You know, I don't know what they noticed. I know they went through my box twice. I brought a box that I packed, and I went out and bought like a mile's worth of twine because I could only buy twine in a Costco size to wrap this box so I could carry it with my CDs in it so I could bring Kalo a CD.
And they broke it open.
Yeah. It's weird. I'm moving towards an iPod, and I'm hating it.
I don't want to mess with it. But, you know, it's funny. They have specific reasons why they stop people and why they open up stuff. I didn't realize when we traveled to England recently, my wife got stopped twice because she was on a British passport traveling with two Americans. That was the only reason why they stopped her. The woman told her.
I'll tell you, these smaller airports I feel safer at. This is Long Beach. I mean, that's a small airport. That's like, you know, there's like two runways there, and there's like only three airlines that fly in and out of there or something like that. It's a tiny little airport. JetBlue services it. And I brought this box with this that was wrapped up in twine. I opened it. I had to cut it open in front of the lady. She had to look in and see my CDs. And then they went through it again behind the scenes. And because it was destroyed. The box was, like, by the time I got it, CDs were almost falling out with stickers on it saying, we inspected this. Well, I'm glad it was safe, but now, right. What about my Lester Young CD? All right. How am I going to enjoy the genius of sax now that you've screwed up my Lester Young CD? I'm glad that you feel content that it wasn't going to blow up, but now I can't blow my brains out with my Lester Young CD. So, I guess there's a price to be paid for the security, but the small airports, I think, really have it together on that because there's just less stuff to go through.
Well, yeah, and they got more time to go through it, too. I mean, you know, we have fewer people that are coming through. They can take more care in checking out people that might tend to look a little
suspicious. I couldn't be more thrilled about Howard Dean. I just could not be more thrilled about Howard Dean. Because let's look at this real quick before we go into Jesus-related topics. All right? Federal spending has increased faster under George W. Bush than at any point in the last 30 years. Current national debt, $7.6 trillion. Bush took the record $236 billion surplus he inherited from Clinton, remember, a good president, and has turned it into a record $422 billion deficit. Okay, that will increase to $427 billion if Bush's next war funding request is approved. This for another
81.9.
Bush has said he'll cut the deficit in half by the time he leaves office, but the Washington Post reports that in trying to do this, Bush has left budgetary landmines galore for whoever follows him. The Post says even if Bush succeeds in slashing the deficit in half in 4 years, as he has pledged, his major policy prescriptions would leave his successor with massive financial commitments that begin rising dramatically the year he relinquishes the White House, according to an analysis of new budget figures. So that means this is what Dick Cheney meant when he said deficits don't matter because we're going to take it out of the poor souls over the next 50 years. We're going to destroy the financial status of this country. Who the hell knows how long this is going to last?
This is what they've been reaching toward for years now. The idea that the deficit looms so large that the only alternative is to cut the, quote, entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, any kind of aid to poor people, any kind of aid to people who can't make it through life on their own. It's all going to get cut, and this country will go to a point of social Darwinism that we have not yet seen.
Well, that's exactly right, Steve. So anybody who's aggravated, if you're poor or you're old and you're aggravated, well, their basic view is you're going to be dead soon unless you find God.
Yes.
I mean, that's the panacea. Is that the word panacea?
Panacea is the word.
Yeah, for everything. Is that like, you know, you can, it's easy to accommodate your dire straits if you have religion in your life because then you have a higher calling. And believe me, they're going to take advantage of it. And I'm telling you, this is where Howard Dean is like right out of the gate, on point, ready to go. We are, it's time to take fiscal responsibility back because these bastards are going to break the country. They're going to kill poor people and they're going to kill the old with their financial or their economic policy. And also they're going to retard the young with their support of religious policy, as we'll find after this. It's 15 past the hour on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
What is it?
Twenty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Hey, you guys.
If you want to oppose the anti-gay rights amendment, the effort to destroy Social Security, the elimination of the filibuster, and the closing of the last abortion clinic in Mississippi, go to the links page at morningsedition.com for Morning Sedition's action alerts. I will be at Symphony Space on Thursday. You can't go. It's sold out. We will be giving away tickets in some form or another. Only a couple of pairs, but we do have a couple of pairs. You can also go to morningsedition.com and blog if you'd like to get involved with that business. You can also buy things, hats, shirts, things, you know, stuff, mouse pads, mugs. I want a Morning Sedition mug. Is there any way we can get some of this stuff for nothing? I mean, what do I got to do? You know,
No.
Michael Shearer, Washington correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine, is going to be with us a little later. And right now, last night, of course, I had a dream. I'm walking in Central Park. There are hundreds of orange gates with orange banners hanging from them. A man stops me and says, hello, my name is Christo. I'm the artist who created this installation. Actually, the gates are not orange, they're saffron. Okay. The dream starts over. I'm walking in Central Park, and there are hundreds of saffron gates with saffron banners hanging from them. I come across a monk wearing saffron robes sitting cross-legged in the sheep's meadow. I ask him, what do the gates represent? He says, the gates are a portal between man's physical and spiritual identities and represent the thin membrane between this finite existence and the eternal, the past with the future. Between earth and sky is a profound mystery, and with each step, we emerge reborn into a new destiny. I say, thanks, Einstein. Everybody's a wise guy here. All right. Then I come across Bill O'Reilly standing knee deep in Bethesda Fountain holding a saffron-colored loofah. He says, the gates are liberal elitists imposing their effete values on the rest of us and then sneering when regular, hardworking Americans don't say, oh, it's a masterpiece. It's beautiful. That's crap. I said, get a grip, Bill. O'Reilly screams, this is clearly the gay agenda trying to lure our kids into the park. Gay agenda! Then his head exploded. It was beautiful. Later, at the Central Park Zoo, I come across a sea lion wearing a saffron-colored moo-moo. The sea lion says, the gates represent Mayor Bloomberg's attempt to cheer up the city that's been continually screwed over by the Bush administration and by the Yankees. Those bastards broke my heart. I come across Christo again wearing a saffron-colored band uniform. I ask him, what do they mean? He nods and says, exactly. Exactly. I woke up and my bed was filled with thousands of delighted tourists. There you go. So here we go. Yesterday, Riley, and this is something you're not going to hear anywhere else because it's early in the morning and this just happened last night, but what set it up happened yesterday.
Yes.
Am I right?
This happened last night. Staunton, Virginia is the place we're talking about. Their school board decided last night to allow Bible classes to continue for elementary school students. This is grades 1 through 3. And this Bible study takes place during class time.
Yeah, let's be clear on this. What happens is, you know, when Bible studies, somebody, I guess, like, you know, through the intercom, there's a... And then a voice comes over and says, for all you believing kids, for you kids who believe in Christ as your Savior, it's time to go have fun time across the street at the church. The rest of you heathens, you little kids with no God in your life who are going to be, you know, the unsaved who are going to be, you know, drug addicts, prostitutes, and have no morality whatsoever, you can stay and just twiddle your thumbs for an hour while the other kids go have cookies and milk with Jesus. So this is what happened during the day. Kids were taken out of school, you know, sent to a church across the street for morality lessons, as if you can't teach morality without religion, the arrogance of these people.
The amazing thing, Mark, is, maybe I shouldn't say the amazing thing, because it seems like this is happening with increasing frequency, almost no matter what issue you talk about, when you talk about gay rights, whatever. You know, a stream suddenly turns into a river. When people began to protest this, and at first they were saying, people who were in favor of these Bible study classes were saying, well, the people that are protesting are outsiders. They're moving to our community from other places. Turns out the bottom line is, A, the people that support the Bible study classes went out and hired Gil Davis. Now, some people may not remember that name, but Gil Davis was the lawyer who at one time represented Miss Paula Jones, remember
her? So now he's at the behest of the Christo-fascist zombie brigades of the neocon death cult?
Well, yeah, he's part of the Rutherford Institute. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was part of the Rutherford Institute when he represented Paula Jones. Mm-hmm. That her whole thing with Clinton was bought and paid for by the Rutherford Institute.
So now, is he still works for the Rutherford Institute?
Yes.
All right, so this is definitely, this is an interesting thing then now, isn't it? That this is a, what, is it a Republican-based organization? Is it a Republican, what is the Rutherford Institute exactly?
The Rutherford Institute is really about church-state issues. And,
okay,
of course, they weigh heavily in favor
of melding the two. Right, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, so there you go.
They supposedly, they say that they defend Christian rights.
Oh,
not that, defend the Christian right,
oh,
you defend Christians' rights.
Isn't it wonderful when they portray themselves that way, that they're the victims here, not these poor kids who just want to, you know, watch SpongeBob and learn something about, you know, the world they live in, not, you know, be brainwashed into thinking that the only way they can be good is by, you know, following a particular ideological path based on mysticism.
Well, you know, when you have a situation when more than 80% of the first to third graders in this school system participate in these Bible study classes, then the other 20% are, I believe, stigmatized. They're the 20% like, well, you're in the minority. Why don't you attend these Bible study classes? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, they're devil children. These are the devil children that are left behind, you know, that don't go, that whose parents say this isn't important. And I can guarantee you, Riley, that in these Bible classes that they only claim to be teaching, you know, morality and good behavior to kids, they're teaching that God invented everything. They're being taught that you cannot, you know, go to heaven without Jesus. They're being taught that, you know, Jesus is the only way. They're being taught a very, you know, selective bit of morality. They are being programmed. I mean, this is part of the Christo-fascist zombie brigade thing. We're going to do the liberal confessional, speaking of religion.
Oh, yeah.
866-303-2270. We're going to be taking your confessions. What are your sins this week? How have you worked against the liberal agenda, the progressive program? What's eating at you?
That's right. Call us and be cleansed here on Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition.
Right now,
call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here, Mark Riley there.
Hey,
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. The facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition. Don't be stupid. Okay. Sometimes it's not easy being a liberal, as certainly I know. But some people, like a lot of liberals, don't know that. they're in that much denial. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Look, man, I want to support my wife, all right? Her writing career in L.A., I mean, she's working really hard. I'm proud of her. I really admire what Neeson is doing.
On the day after Valentine's Day, that's where you should end that sentence, but go on.
But part of me just wants to say, okay, Wolf, enough is enough. Just come back here and have my baby.
So wait a minute. Let me get this straight. Right. Your talented, ambitious wife should leave L.A. and all the contacts she's made there.
Well, yeah. Well, she could still work here just with my baby.
You want her to abandon her dreams of any professional success she might achieve on her own?
Well, yeah. Well, no. She can still have those dreams just with my babies in them.
You want her to devote herself entirely to the breeding of little Mark Maron.
No,
admit it.
No. Not entirely. I mean, as I said, my babies will be an addition in her life. It's all in the framing, Riley. It's a good thing.
I think you're lying to yourself, Mark Maron. You want her to be a baby machine. I have met Mishna Wolf, and she is much more than two functioning ovaries.
Okay. You're right, Riley. Okay, of course she is. It's just that she'll be such a great mom. I want to mingle my inferior DNA with her superior DNA to produce a line of Super Marons. I mean, wouldn't that be cool?
Will those little Super Marons grow up to think that other people's dreams aren't worth as much as their own?
All right. Okay.
Great. I feel like crap. Good for you. All right. I don't need babies. Happy? All right. Wait, I got penance coming, right? I can feel it.
You certainly do. For your penance, you have to spend the weekend caring for someone's children. At least three of them.
Wow.
That means cooking, laundry, and if necessary, diapers. Oh. This should give you a whole new perspective on that baby business.
Oh, thank you, Brother Riley.
Now go forth and sin no more.
Oh, babies. You know, right when he said I want him, but now I'm like, oh, now I'm thinking about it. Because my brother's got three kids. Maybe I'll just go to his house. You know, Riley, thanks for the penance, first of all. But the confessional is no fun without penance. So if anyone else is out there wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. And for you progressive utopians with no sense of humor, this is fun time, so I don't know. You're going to have to deal with that. Molly, listening to WINZ in Miami, good morning. What's your sin?
Hi, Mark. I just want you to know that I'm an evangelical Christian and I'm a liberal.
Wow. Okay, so now I'm assuming that you're presenting that to me because you know that I will say, well, that's a sin to be an evangelical Christian.
Exactly.
All right, Molly, let me just ask a couple questions. Do you believe the Bible is literal?
You know what? All my life I did until recently.
Well, that's great. That's okay. That must have been liberating in and of itself.
But I feel guilty
for being evangelical. Well, I tell you what you have to do. I know because you're carrying a good burden and a big burden, and I know that Christian principles are very important to the progressive agenda because they are good. All right, but what you're going to have to do is continue to dismantle the myths of Christianity and free yourself from the bonds of delusion.
I just don't know if I can. I think I can still be an evangelical Christian, but still be a good person and a liberal and help, you know, want to help people, want to help poor people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't understand Bush. I just don't understand him.
I think that if you just focus on the works and not the faith, you might have a little more freedom around that. That's what I say. Try helping people. I say maybe try not to mention Jesus for 2 days.
Well, you know what? I usually don't.
Okay.
I usually don't. I mean, I'm an evangelical Christian. That's my background. But you know what? I don't go around mentioning Jesus every day.
Well, I think you're on the right path already, and you've made me very happy.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Molly. You take care.
Thanks, Molly. Wow.
It's funny. She's an evangelical Christian, but as I talk more and more to her, I'm like, she's not really an evangelical Christian anymore, you know?
It seems like she doesn't really need a penance either.
It's very hard to evangelize without mentioning Jesus every couple minutes, you know what I mean? All right, what do we got here? We got Gary listening to XM in South Carolina. How are you, Gary?
What's your sin, my friend? My sin is very old.
Oh, that happens. It just sticks in there. Like it sticks like a splinter, and you usually make a little pearl of guilt out of it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Back in 1960, I was during the Kennedy, Nixon. Oh, I can't even say Nixon. I was 3 months away from being able to vote. I was only 20, right?
Yeah.
But I was so... I don't know if Mark Riley, maybe you remember that campaign. I don't know how old you are.
I do.
You're older than
I was
Aaron.
A kid, but I do remember it very clearly.
All right. Well, I don't know. Do you recall the really rock star persona that Kennedy seemed to typify? I mean, the girls standing around screaming. And do you remember all that
stuff?
Oh,
yeah. He was a pre-Beatles Beatle, and he really won that campaign during what was then the first televised debate in America.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, because Nixon broke into a heavy sweat.
Sweat, yeah.
looked like a suspect in the interrogation room.
Yep, that was the first debate I ever watched.
Oh, yeah?
So what was your sin? So anyway, I grew up in a Republican family, and had I been able to vote, I was very put off by Kennedy.
Yeah, all that charm and smartness and sexuality.
Yeah, the paradigm changed with that election. And I'd seen other campaigns before that. It was all very serious and all, you know. Anyway, I would have voted for Nixon.
Oh.
And it wasn't until about maybe 5-6 years later that my political orientation changed and I began to realize the enormity of my sin.
Well, it sounds like you paid some heavy penance, but, my friend, we have a new rock star in the Democratic Party. Howard Dean is back.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know if I'd call him a rock star exactly.
All right, well, he doesn't have the same juice, all right? He doesn't have the same Kennedy juice, but he's definitely the raw, exciting, he's got the new fresh ideas, I think.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, so,
what do you got to do? What's your penance?
All these years, it's been growing. I need to be absolved.
Well, first you have to go out of your way to support boring and unsexy Democrats at every point that you can, and maybe send a little money to the new Democratic National Committee.
There you go.
What do you say?
I can do that.
Yeah, and also, it sounds like the penance that you've done for all these years
has
just been festering. Hey,
that's 45 years ago now.
Hey, just because somebody seems to be having a better time with you than you, there's no reason to resent them. Take it easy, buddy.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Gary. It's so funny because that was, I really think that a lot of that in terms of the culture was the reason why so many Republicans reacted so strongly against Clinton was like, who the hell's that guy to have fun? Who the hell is that guy to have charm? And look at him. It's easy for him. Screw that guy. It's easy for him, and he can get whatever he wants. No. And he's not Republican. There's no way. No, not letting that happen. All right, what do we got? Jill and Madison streaming. How are you?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. What's your sin?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I try so hard not to spend money with places that give money to conservatives.
Sure.
And I work as a project manager, and I travel over 50 nights a year, and I stay in Marriott. That's terrible.
Oh. Well, I think I might have something for you if you're going to have to stay on the phone, Jill, because I'm assuming you're staying there because your company pays for Marriott's.
Yep.
And you don't have a choice in the matter.
I do not.
Wow. All right, so we're going to have to think of a pretty good penance for you. So stay on the phone. We'll get to you after the break. It's 43 past the hour. We're taking your sins, 866-303-227, and we're turning them into goodness. Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
The program is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. And we got Jill on the phone who is, for her job, they put her up at Marriott's, and she feels bad because Marriott is a big Republican contributor. Am I getting your sin right, Jill?
Absolutely.
And you got no choice. You got to stay at the Marriott's because that's your company throwing the bill.
Well, you know what? It's kind of a catch-22 because our customers pay for it and their hospital. So I could stay somewhere else like a Hyatt. That gives to them, but they cost more, and it's taking money from a hospital.
Wow, this is pretty...
That's an ethical dilemma.
Well, here we go. I've done some research for you. Now, there's a couple of penance. The easier one is to... maybe you could put disclaimer stickers in the Gideon's Bibles saying that, warning, this a lot of it is this is just a story. You could also put put Democratic Party literature into the Bibles. But here's what I think...
It's awesome. I'm doing it.
You're doing it? Okay. Because I think that one's going to be easier than the real penance, which is Marriott Hotels in the last election donated $142,975 to Republicans, but they also... this is according to ChooseTheBlue.com. But they also donated $45,150 to Democrats, the difference being $97,825, which you're going to have to start making up. You're going to... I don't know how long it's going to take, but you're going to have to balance that out to the Democrats if you could. Start with the stickers and the literature, and then every once in a while kick a few bucks over to the Democrats.
Oh, we're coming.
Okay, Jill. Thank you for calling.
All right, Jill.
Goodbye. Bye-bye. Take care. I think we helped another sinner, Riley.
Well, she was a project manager. That's a lot of project managing to make up 90 Gs.
Okay.
Is it 90 Gs? Did you say 90-something?
It's a lot to make up, and it's going to take some time. Brian, listening to LIB in New Jersey. What's up, Brian?
Hey.
What's your sin?
My sin, well,
first of all, my sin is I work for a company that's in the business of outsourcing.
Okay, well, that's bad. So, okay, so
yeah,
you're...
but, you know, I got to pay the bills, you know?
I guess, Brian.
Working on that. But my sin is, you know, I've been watching what Bush has been saying about the privatization of Social Security. Yeah. And, you know, I kind of keep an open mind about it. And, you know, thinking, well, if as long as he makes it an option... Is it really all that bad?
See, here's what's happening. Do you see where you started this conversation? Is you work for a company that outsources, and see how it's polluting your soul? You're keeping an open mind to a president that doesn't even understand what he's talking about when he's talking about Social Security. And
he doesn't even have a mind. I sometimes think.
So because you've made this sacrifice to work for a company that outsources, which I know it's difficult to, you know, in whatever line you're in, or it's difficult for a lot of people not to work for those companies, I'm sure that you're doing that to make a living. So what I want you to do is just from here on out until you are of retirement age, once a week, just take like a third of your check and go down to Atlantic City and put it on red. and see how that works for you. And get back to me when you're 65 and let me know how you did, and then we'll talk about how you feel about Social Security.
See, the thing is, I personally would not opt for it.
Dude, come on. What, are we going to have this conversation? All right, talk to you later, Brian. Take it easy.
Yeah. Think $2 trillion, folks.
The whole thing is screwy. Just, you know, jack up the tax a little bit, and, you know, let it correct itself and shut up already. This would be such a landfall for the banking establishment. A windfall. Windfall to you, landfall to me, or is it landfill? That's what this is. This is a landfill for the consumer. That's what it is. It's a landfall. It's a hybrid. That's what all Republican policy pitching is. They're not windfalls. I couldn't follow that all the way through. Obviously, it's going to be a big sort of, you know, organized kickback to the banking, you know, industry, to the stock industry, they're just trying to deplete people's money, you know, and they're killing seniors. That's all I'm saying.
Well, they're trying to shift that money to people who will kick it right back to them in the form of campaign contributions.
It's awful. It's just leave it be. Just, you know, jack up the tax, let it correct itself, shut up. Carol, listening to LIB in Long Island, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm a little worked up.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
Okay.
What's your sin?
So, my sin is that I've been a fairly good liberal, but, like, and I'm a therapist, and I used to be a social worker who worked with poor people, and I realized when I saw Hotel Rwanda that I could have been seeing Hotel Bronx, Hotel Manhattan, and that when Bush actually said, God wants everyone to be free, I said to him, you know, okay, I'll take you to the South Bronx. And my sin is that I was very active in the campaign, but I think the Democrats, including me, have forgotten about poor people.
I think you're absolutely right.
And I think that's disgusting and dangerous.
I think you're absolutely right. What happened there?
Our phone, yeah.
That's an interesting point, because a lot of people who start out, it's sort of like, you know, my father did his, when he was coming up, he did his internship at Metropolitan Hospital in New York.
Manhattan.
Yeah, it was pretty hairy at one point in time. And, you know, a lot of these people that get into social work, who get into psychotherapy, they sort of make their bones doing, you know, legitimate, you know, honest-to-God social work. But as time goes on, you know, and they start seeing, you know, clients that have money. My therapist is a social worker. I don't go to a psychiatrist. I'm not in analysis. My guy's a registered, he's a CSW. And a lot of them get away from the actual sort of, you know, hands-on social work with real people in real need, you know, who are strapped economically, who are in a bad situation in a relationship, drugs, whatever, who are poor, and in favor of this clientele that can give them more money. And there is that weird moment where you wake up and you realize, you know, oh my God, you know, I've sold out, I've sacrificed, you know, what I got into this for, because a lot of those people, that's a tough job, it's a noble job, and it feels hopeless.
You know, working poor people are, I think you can legitimately say, we're forgotten during a good part of last year's campaign by the Democrats because they were trying to reach that, quote, middle class, the soccer moms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that our caller wasn't the only person that forgot about poor people, certainly during the last campaign. And I think there's going to be a focus with Howard Dean in charge of the DNC. That focus is going to come back on poor people and the issues that are important to the
poor.
Well,
you know, it's a strange thing, you know, because, you know, I experience sometimes, I think what people experience and where a lot of it, the guilt comes from in Democrats and liberals is that there's a lot of people that make a pretty good amount of money. Mm-hmm. And when you make a pretty good amount of money, you know, any person is going to look at the money that goes to the government and say, wow, that's a lot of money that's going to the government. You know, and you know, the truth of the matter is until people are comfortable with paying their share of taxes, you know, in order to make this, you know, to make the country and, you know, work the way it's supposed to work and make the government work the way it's supposed to work. They don't trust the government with their money. But Democrats feel that as well, that they don't want to give the money away. So that those priorities, once people make money, is certainly not with, you know, caring about people who can't, who have a hard time helping themselves.
But see, the other side of that, Mark, the next step where you cross that line is in saying that the poor are not somehow worthy of the
that's
money
what I'm
that's
saying,
being funneled
into
them. Yeah.
Once Democrats, once the larger group of people makes enough money to change their ideology,
yeah,
not necessarily become a Republican, but that their core values are not based in, they're not based in authenticity.
Yeah, I work hard for this money, and now suddenly it's going over here to this person, and I'm not sure that person is going to actually use it to better themselves. There's a whole lot that comes with that. But I think, I don't know, I wonder sometimes whether or not a political party, as opposed to just plain people, are the best folks to try and change that mindset.
Well, I'll tell you, we'll talk about Howard Dean when we come back. We'll also talk a little bit about the scam of faith-based initiatives later in the hour if we have some time.
Yeah.
You know, just briefly. I don't know if we will, but I think we might. But
oh, we'll have time.
But they pay a lot of lip service to that this is like we're giving money to people who are going to help people, but
yeah,
those people never get helped, and the money just goes into the pockets of large religious congregations who are being bought.
Well,
it's
never
Party.
As much money as the Republicans say it's going to be. Bush has been pledging all this money. He hasn't delivered. And as a result, a lot of people that are in that faith-based community are thinking he's just paying lip service to us.
Right, but they also don't force them to account for the money properly.
No, they don't. And we'll get to that and a whole lot more when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Sedition, fighting treason with reason. This is Air America Radio.
Yes, here we go, 6 past the hour. It's morning sedition on Air America Radio. You're listening to me, Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley right there. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and, of course, all of you who like to listen to the radio because it feels like thinking. Good morning to you. How you doing, Mark Riley?
I'm doing great, man. How you doing?
I feel pretty good. You know, we've been going here for a couple hours. Things are looking up,
yep.
I guess, for the morning.
Yep.
And so I'm very excited to be back. I had a nice long weekend with my wife. I had a great time doing Jerusalem Syndrome for the first time in 2 years. It went remarkably well, and I'm not one to toot my own horn. I will tell that to my listeners right now. I usually will toot the other way. I will celebrate my sadness before I celebrate any success at all. But I tell you, it was great to get back into that show. It was great to get into a script that I'd written when I was out of my mind. It was nice to have the distance to actually, as opposed to actually being out of my mind, I got to act like I was out of my mind. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
Also, you know, quickly, my pet, my new thing, Splenda, is quickly becoming everybody's new thing, apparently. It is everywhere. The yellow packets, they've stolen the hearts and minds of Americans and the world. Well, Big Sugar is getting mad. Big Sugar, the president of the National Sugar Association, Andrew C. Briscoe III, joined the executive director of Center for Science and Public Interest, Dr. Michael Jacobson. To say that Splenda is not natural. It is not made from sugar. They're really mad with the advertising.
They're mad with the thing that it says on the package that, where is it? Oh, no. Come on, buddy. Come on. Where is it? You dummy. I am a dummy.
What are you talking about?
Well, it's made from sugar, so it tastes like sugar.
Yeah, that's their catchphrase.
Well, sugar's mad because apparently people are like, you know what, we don't need sugar. This stuff is so good, we don't need it. And it's not as stinky tasting as Sweet and Low. And it doesn't do that weird thing to your mouth that Equal does. So everyone's scared. Splenda is taking over the world. And they've shaken the palace of the great god Sugar. You cannot say that you come from me. You're a bastard child. You were made in a lab. You are not the legacy of me, real sugar, the juice of the mind that has controlled the people for hundreds of thousands of years from the days when they just suck on fruit to having great big boxes of it to make children crazy and have diabetes and exhaustion and make them fat now. No. No, you are no child of mine, the great god Sucrose said to Splenda, it's bastard child made in a laboratory. But I don't care what anybody says. And then they've got a doctor on the payroll that says, we don't know what this stuff is going to do. So what's new? Who cares? Are you kidding me? I put a little in my tea. I feel like a normal person. I feel like I'm a guy that gets to enjoy sugar. And I'm not tooting Splenda's horn either. To me, it's just better than Sweet and Low. And
that's the problem.
Yeah, and Equal makes my mouth feel weird, and sugar makes me carry water.
Whoa.
Yeah. Anyways, enough about me. No, are you kidding? There's never enough about me. Let's talk about this. An ex-aide to Bush, a guy who was a deputy to... this guy, David Kuo, he was a deputy director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives for much of Bush's first term, has come out and basically said that the money's not there. They're paying a lot of lip service to this and that. They're blowing some smoke. They're throwing some money into the pockets of certain clergymen who have delivered a certain amount of their congregation, but it's bogus.
He's saying that the process is political and that the process and actually the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives is a cynical political ploy on the part of the Bush administration, largely because they never fund a lot of these initiatives to the tune that they say they're going.
And this was said where now?
This was said in an essay published on BeliefNet.com.
And don't misunderstand, this guy is not on our team. This guy is no friend of liberals. But this guy is, if you read the piece on BeliefNet, you will find that he's a broken-hearted religious conservative.
Yes.
Who really believes. And it's funny that he is really coming to terms in this piece with his own sadness around the false promise of compassionate conservatism. Yet he goes out of his way to make sure that he portrays liberals as reactionary idiots who overreact to anything that has to do with faith. You know, which is that's his Achilles heel here, because you know what he's really trying to say is that in his heart he's a liberal in the way he sees how people should be treated.
Well, he used to work for Ted Kennedy, apparently, or worked in his one of his election campaigns. So I guess he's one of those guys who ponged from the left over to the right. But the one thing that was very revealing in his essay on BeliefNet.com was this whole idea that the anti-gang initiative, Laura Bush's anti-gang initiative, the $150 million over 3 years, well, that annual cost is coming out of a request of $100 million for an existing faith-based project, the Compassion Capital Fund, which was supposed to be funded to a much higher tune. So in other words, the monies that they're talking about giving Laura Bush to give out under this anti-gang initiative didn't come out of the general treasury. They came out of another project that Bush is already underfunding.
Okay. And also it seems to be that, there were a lot of reaching out. He writes in his piece, and I'll quote him, between 2002 and 2004, more than 15,000 white, Hispanic, and African-American religious and social service leaders attended free White House conferences on how to interact with the federal government in terms of getting grants and money. The meetings, held regularly in battleground states, were chock full of vital information, gave thousands of groups invaluable information about government grants. They were hardly pep rallies for the president, but the conferences sent a resounding political message to all faith-oriented constituencies, which is President Bush cares about you, which in retrospect he does not unless you are completely willing
to deliver voters. And even then, he does not give the money necessary to actually engage in any of the initiatives that were set forth, you know, i.e., you know, helping people, you know, helping the homeless, helping with drug programs, helping people, you know, solve problems in their lives. You know, this is a big write-off. You know, and ultimately there was no enforcement of how the money was used, and it was just a big bribe to get clergy to get their voters to the polls for this president.
Well, the one thing, and if you think you've heard some of this guy's remarks before, if you think that it sounds familiar, it probably does, because David Quote's not the first person to come out and say this. In fact, the guy who formerly headed the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, John DiIulio Jr., said essentially the same thing. Quote, there is a virtual absence as yet of any policy accomplishments that might, to a fair-minded nonpartisan, count as the flesh on the bones of so-called compassionate conservatism. This was in an interview with Esquire magazine. He said that this is a result of governing by politics, not governing by policy.
Right. This is like, yeah, this is him saying that basically DiIulio said that the administration's domestic policies are determined entirely by political considerations, with everything being run by the office of Karl Rove. Now, given that Karl Rove has now got a new title as deputy chief of staff, you know, the power that he's able to consolidate now is frightening. We're going to be talking to Michael Shearer, the Washington correspondent for Mother Jones, in the next half hour about specifically that, Mark Riley.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, this undercutting of the faith-based initiative thing is interesting given, you know, two former Bush people. And remember that they have managed, the Bush administration seems to have done an extraordinary job of keeping most people that have been in the administration on the ranch even after they leave. Richard Clark, of course, is an exception. A couple other people are exceptions. But the rule has been, you know, you stay on the ranch. You don't criticize the boss. Well, these guys have stepped forward and said essentially that this whole faith-based initiative thing was part of a political superstructure that has been, as you point out, supervised by guys like Karl Rove and now is in the process of implementation by guess who? The new head of the Republican National Committee, Ken Melman, who just the other week was speaking to blacks, including black clergymen in Prince George's County, Maryland.
It don't get us wrong here. I mean, you know, this guy, David Quo's, you know, jumping off the ship is not nearly as dramatic or enticing or as intelligent as DiIulio's was.
No.
Because, you know, Quo is an underling, and he's also someone who refuses to let go of the language of the right, you know, and basically he is talking, you know, he doesn't, you know, waste any time, you know, within seconds of the beginning of this piece to blow some smoke up the arse of the administration, you know, and say how much he loves conservatism and how much, you know, he is disappointed and saddened that someone is great and wonderful as George W. Bush let him down in this way, but nonetheless helped him in other ways, you know. But, you know, he is nonetheless saying that it was all politics.
Well, yeah, and he's putting a different spin on it than DiIulio did. DiIulio put the laid the blame squarely at the feet of the president.
Let's talk about Howard Dean when we come back, because he's got me worked up, man. You know, he is saying things. Let me tell you something. You know, how come we got to wait for this guy to make a decision to be DNC chairman and talk like all Democrats should be talking right now? Mind-blowing. 16 past the hour. We'll hear it when we come back. Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition on the air and online. Morning'sEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Hi.
It feels like thinking. 21 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Air America Radio. I'm the great god Sucrose. Splenda, you were exiled. To the land of Hades, where you will live with other chemical sweeteners. You cannot claim a legacy to me. I am Sucrose, God's sugar. Okay, sorry. Here we go. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So I, Mark Riley, just bought, as some of you will know, a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator that makes noises. So let's crank this baby up and see, feed it some headlines. Here we go. Okay, from the New York Times. It's warming up. You all right? Okay, good. From the New York Times, U.S. seems sure of the hand of Syria, hinting at penalties. Feed that in there. U.S. seems sure of the hand of Syria, hinting at penalties. Translation, Bush runs Syria war up flagpole. Times editor salute. That. There you go. That worked. From news, from Fox News, Jackson witness list studded with stars. How about that? I-5 News 5000 thing. Translator. Translation. Hard up B-listers beg Michael Jackson for scraps of attention. Yes. Okie dokie. Okie dokie doodle. Oh, good golly, Miss Molly. This is ponderous, man. All right, here we go. I'm telling you, man, ponderous. All right. From Reuters, okay, hungry man holds up store, demands sushi. Hungry man holds up store, demands sushi. Translation, man holds wasabi to own temple, screams, I'll do it! That was the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headliner translator. Ponderous, man, I tell you, it's ponderous. Good golly, Miss Molly. 2 o'clock. Ponderous. Anyways, that's for people who know, people who don't. There's nothing I can help you with. All right, let's get into this. Howard Dean, Mark Riley. I'm sitting in L.A., Los Angeles, Sunday night. You know, I get the email I get occasionally from Larson, occasionally every night, with somebody at Clutch Larson who came in a little later today. He's feeling kind of chipper, full of the beans. Stable. Looking good.
Full of the beans.
You know, and they're just like, you know, full, you know, he's like, hey, I'm ready to go. Yeah, he's on a new schedule, and we're happy to have him. So it's going to be nice to have someone who can function after 2 o'clock in the afternoon here, you know, representing the show just so people don't, you know, screw up our computers or leave crap around our office. If anything, Larson will be doing that in the afternoon. So, they'll just be the presence to go, no, you can't come in because the last time you were in here.
I was wrong.
Oh, now how would that come from? That doesn't make any sense. I don't know what I was thinking. I was thinking that if I pushed it, I would say you were wrong. Anyways, Howard Dean, ponderous, man, I'm telling you, ponderous. Howard Dean, I read this thing, I read his speech on Sunday night, and I get excited. I feel that little juice, that, you know, I feel like my spirit, you know, rising, becoming erect, my friend. You understand? Because just to hear a Democrat talk like this again, you know, I haven't heard since he, you know, was running.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to hear it, Kayla. Can we just shoot me full of Dean here?
The budget does not account for the cost of the war in Iraq. It does not account for their agenda of privatizing Social Security. It cuts education, cuts children's health, cuts veterans' benefits, and cuts community policing. And as far as I'm concerned, that budget does two things. It brings Enron-style accounting to the nation's capital. And it demonstrates once again that what Americans, all Americans, are now beginning to see, you cannot trust Republicans with your money.
How great is that? Why aren't they all talking like that? What is this? I mean, they should, yeah, thank God. You know, the thing is Karl Rove and all of these Republicans really bank on the idea that we will forget Riley. And I'm telling you, it's ponderous, man.
Now, that was Howard Dean speaking Saturday in Washington after he assumed that was his acceptance speech.
Yes.
As chair of the DNC. Now, the real question is going to be, will there be a unified, coordinated strategy between Democrats in Congress and the DNC with an eye toward both the 06 midterms and the 08 presidential election? And that's going to be the central question. There seems to be some indication that Democrats in Congress are starting to try to enforce the same kind of discipline on their members that the Republicans are used to dealing with since Bush has been elected in 2000. In other words, you dangle out committee chairmanships, and more importantly, you have an organization that threatens to run candidates against people who get off the ranch.
Huh.
That's something the Republicans have had with an organization called the Club for Growth. It's a conservative organization, a real arch-conservative organization, and if Republican moderates go too far in trying to accommodate Democrats, or, for example, say they're against Social Security, the likelihood is the Club for Growth is going to run somebody against them in a primary.
Okay.
And at the very least cost them a whole bunch of money, and in the, under an ideal circumstance, replace a moderate with a conservative.
Unbelievable. Political coercion within the party. They threaten their own guys.
So well, yeah, but it's worked.
Sure.
With the Republicans, it's worked. And now we're starting to see the Democrats trying to do the same kind of thing.
If five Democrats in the House, if five of them would talk like Dean, five. You know what I mean? If one of them would speak with some passion and conviction about, you know, what the real values are. I mean, the national debt is $7.6 trillion. This is the gap. This is the hole we need to hit them. This is the kidney punch.
Yeah.
You got to make people realize these people are bankrupting the country for the, you know, for years and years to come.
Yeah, I mean, he's going back to the well for $81.9 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. And Karl Rove is the guy that erases the memory of the people. We're going to talk about how with somebody who knows after this.
It's Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Ponderous. 34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. That's right. Don't be stupid. Listen, Air America feels like thinking. Hey. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that small world. It's actually a large world, isn't it? Yes, it is. So now on the phone, once again, is Planet Bush correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Hey, good morning, Mark. God's got a wok, and he's stir-fried sinner.
Oh, good.
Sizzling.
Yes, that God eats
Sizzle
that. Oh, yeah. Well, listen, buddy, let's talk about North Korea. Doesn't it frighten you that they might have nuclear weapons?
It's nuclear, Mark,
nope.
And not really. You know, come on. North Korea doesn't have real nuclear weapons. They've got Asian nuclear weapons. That Tinker Toy stuff held together with bamboo shoots and soy sauce.
Come on. Lawton, what are you talking about?
All right, if we go to war, their nuclear missile will go up in the air and probably explode into a chrysanthemum or a panda or something. It'll be like something the Kiwanis Club sets off at a 4th of July barbecue. You know, for all the good it'll do, Kim Jong-il might as well throw stale kimchi at it.
Now, come on.
Here, take that.
No, I think you're underestimating this, okay? What do you think about Kim Jong-il? He's scary, man. Isn't he a scary guy?
Well, okay. Now, normally I like anybody with three names.
Oh.
Billy Ray Cyrus. Rebecca Romijn Stamos,
mm-hmm.
Jada Pinkett Smith.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but Kim Jong-il, come on, Mark, you can't take this guy seriously.
Why not?
You can't.
Why?
He's nothing but a whiny little squirt still PO'd because we dropped the nukes on him in World War II.
That was Japan, Lawton.
Well, obviously, I meant the Korean section of Japan.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Mark, come on, stay with me.
What was I thinking?
Stay with me.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
You know, that Kim Jong-il reminds me an awful lot of Howard Dean.
Wait a minute.
They're both only 4'8".
No.
You know, that's a fact. You give Dean a bad haircut, some square glasses, and a Mao jacket, those two could double date.
Oh, come
on. I'm not
on.
Even kidding. President Bush should just turn them both over his knee and give them a good spanking.
Come on. Kim Jong-il's got a huge army. He poses a legitimate military threat. You know, Bush won't be able to bully them like he did Iraq. I mean, wake up.
Oh, Mark.
What?
We could wipe out the North Koreans in an afternoon after lunch in a nap.
No, come on.
Even if we have to go to war over there, it's going to be fun. You ever watch MASH?
Yes.
They're always cutting up and peeping at nurses in the shower, and Hawkeye's always making martinis, and Klinger dresses up like a girl. It's like Club Med over there.
Well,
I almost want to go to war.
Come on. First of all, that's a TV program. TV program, all right? Now, second of all, this
is on a lot.
All right, well, that makes it true. You're right. I'm sorry. My mistake.
Every day, really.
Okay, I understand. So you're right. That's exactly what it's like. This is a catastrophe, Lawton, but you don't seem to be taking it seriously at all.
Mash.
No, I'm talking about the real Korea. It's North Korea is a catastrophe.
I'm not taking it seriously because Asia's not going to be a real player in the future anyway.
What are you talking about?
They just don't have the discipline, Mark. They got poor organizational skills. No science.
Yeah, my friend,
have you noticed that?
Listen
no
to me.
Science
Martin,
in Asia.
Listen, do you understand that you are the only person in the world who believes this? That
no
you are you are completely alone in this understanding you have. Alone. Do you understand? Yes.
I am alone. I'm so alone.
Yes.
After those Valentine's Day. You know how many Valentines I got?
No, I don't
know. You know how many?
No, how many?
None.
No.
Zero. Goose egg.
I'm not falling
You're
for this.
You're the only one who will talk to me.
I'm not falling for this.
What? This is the loneliest number.
No, I'm not falling for this.
Badass one.
Come on.
It's the loneliest number.
Take it easy. Take it easy. Please just take it easy. Take it easy.
Would you send me a Valentine? Please?
Oh.
Do I have to beg?
I don't know. I come
Do
on.
Do I have to beg? With a little heart?
Oh, God.
A poem?
No.
A kitten?
No. All right, okay. I'll send you a Valentine. Okay, Lonnie? All right, you'll feel better.
So lonely.
You'll feel better if I send you one? Because I can't take this crap anymore.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
You know one thing the Koreans have going for them? The Great Wall.
No,
it might be a challenge getting through that.
You can
see that thing from the moon.
China. It's in China, Lon. China.
The
China.
Korean Great Wall of
China.
Koreans.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Lon. Goodbye.
God loves you. Deal with it.
Okay. Very good. All right.
Wait, did he just say the Great Wall of Korea?
Yes, he did. He's a very smart man, that Lon Smalls. On the phone, I'm excited to speak to Michael Shearer. He's the Washington, D.C. He's in Washington, D.C. He's a Washington correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. And we are going to talk to him now about Karl Rove. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks a lot for having me.
Good morning. I'm glad you're here because I'm frightened. Now, tell me about this new position, Deputy Chief of Staff. What does that mean? How much power is involved with that? Because we already know that this guy is the weird sort of black widow spinning the web around the world to begin with. What does this give him more of?
Well, it gives him a better office, probably. He's going to move down from the second floor to the first floor of the West Wing, just a few doors away from the Oval Office.
I was under the impression that he could actually, you know, he actually dematerializes and move through walls and be in any office he wants at any time.
That's right. I mean, yeah, for 4 years now, he's been at least the third most powerful person in the White House, next to the president, the vice president, and you know, at times and in different topics, that's even debatable.
In your mind, what order do they go in?
Right. It depends on the subject. I mean, if you're talking about politics or if you're talking about the reelection campaign or talking with the Republican Party's base, he's the most powerful. He's more in touch with them than either the president or the vice president. What happened was he was given a new title. He's already assistant to the president. He's a senior advisor to the president. Now he's the deputy chief of staff to the president. Technically, what that means is he's going to take on some roles as a liaison to a number of the policy committees, the committees within the White House that are supposed to come up with policy on homeland security, national security, domestic affairs, economic policy. Practically, I think what it means, though, is that he's shifting his focus away from reelections to being full-time on policy issues to try and push the country and the Republican Party towards his goal, which he's been very clear about for a number of years, and that is creating a Republican majority in this country for another generation. I mean, he's looking beyond the next 4 years. And in a couple of years, this president's going to become a lame duck. It may happen in a couple months. And he's going to be, you know, living out the last years of his term in the White House. But Karl Rove is looking for something much bigger. He wants Republicans to maintain the White House and to maintain the Congress for another, you know, 20 or 30 years, and that's what he's going to be focusing his energy on.
Michael, there is a chief of staff. His name is Andrew Card. If I were him and saw Karl Rove moving into a deputy position, I'd be a little nervous. Is he?
I can't speak for Andy Card's own personal thoughts. He's a pretty private fellow. But, you know, there's been a lot of speculation over the last week that Andy Card's not going to stay for the full term. It's questionable whether Karl would want Andy's job. I mean, Andy's job is to be the president's right-hand man, to control the president's time, to figure out who has access, who doesn't have access. It's a lot of paper pushing. It's a lot of logistics. Karl Rove is a deep strategist. I mean, he's the architect, as the president said. But clearly, yeah, Karl Rove's star is rising. I mean, he won this re-election for the president. He's won now three elections for the president, if you count 2000. And each election, the president has done better and better. If you count, you know, the midterm elections, Republicans picked up House seats in the House at a time when everyone sort of expected Republicans to lose seats in the House and the Senate. So his star is rising. He's lived up to his reputation as this sort of magician behind the scenes.
Michael, will Karl Rove, in your judgment, play any role in trying to keep Republican members of Congress on the ranch about issues, for example, like Social Security, where there seems to be some people, there seem to be some flow away from the president, even among Republicans?
He already is playing that role. I mean, he's the chief person there. The strategy memos that have been coming out of the White House have been coming from Rove's deputies. What I said before about the lame duck role of the president a few years, I mean, people in the House and in the Senate, Republicans, see that the president doesn't have to run for reelection. But even after the president leaves, they're going to need to be friends with Karl Rove. I mean, he's going to maintain a lot of power in the party. He has all the phone numbers of everyone in the party base. He has lines into all the party's fundraisers. So, you know, even as the president's star begins to fall, Karl Rove will still have some leverage there. And he's already taken over that role.
All right, Michael Scheer, now what you're saying to me is very frightening, is that you're saying that for most practical purposes, when this guy walks into these committees and starts to sort of advise them on policy construction, they are not looking at somebody that is speaking for the president. They are looking for somebody who is actually more important. They are looking at him as that.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, right now, Karl works for the president. Everything he does is at the president's pleasure. But in a few years, when the president leaves office, and in just a couple years, when the president becomes a lame duck, Karl Rove is going to maintain the kingmaker status that he has now.
Right. Now, from your experience, and I'm just asking you to speculate here, you know, I'm tired of talking about this guy, even in context of him being an evil genius as a genius, okay? You know, I'm just tired of it. I find him annoying and pasty, and I know he's in love with George Bush. Now, the thing that I want to know is, what are his weaknesses? Do you see anything?
Well, he's taking a lot of risks. I mean, if you look at even just Social Security, it's a political loser, and it's been a political loser for decades, and everyone's known that. He's taking it on, head on. And so I think if he has weaknesses, it's hubris. It's thinking that he can do anything now that he's been winning so much. And we'll see. I mean, a lot of it will depend on whether the Democrats can get their message together and get themselves together in the Congress and actually mount a legitimate opposition to the president's message. But I think they've definitely extended themselves. I mean, the other weakness Rove has is once you become the dominant party in Washington,
mm-hmm.
you begin to fracture. I mean, for a long time now, for more than a decade, Republicans have had the comfort of feeling that they were the rebels, that they were the rebellious forces who were taking over the Democratic establishment in Washington. Now they're saddled with all the problems that the Democratic establishment had back in the 70s and the 80s in Congress. I mean, there's all these charges of corruption. They're in bed with the lobbyists in the same way. They're bloating the federal budget in the same way Democrats used to be bloating the federal budget. And so his own party is beginning to fracture.
You think he's nervous about Howard Dean?
There was a lot of reports during the campaign that he was really excited for Howard Dean to be running against his guy. I don't know if that was just spin or if he really was excited. I think they have plenty of research to try and destroy Howard Dean, and I wouldn't be surprised if in a couple weeks you start seeing a pretty concerted effort, like you saw with Harry Reid, of trying to take him apart, to convince America that he's a fringe nut that shouldn't be taken seriously.
No, it's not going to happen. Thanks a lot, Michael Scheer. It was great talking to you.
Thanks, yes. Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was Michael Scheer from Mother Jones Magazine. He's the Washington reporter. A little insight. Nice talking to him. When we come back, we're going to recap Iraq, or as I'm calling it now, Iran. We'll be back 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
I'm Reverend Al Sharpton, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Talk about the issues we're fighting for our lives here on Air America Radio.
Parachute in this time. 50 past the hour, Mark Maron. Oh, it just turned to 51. I like when the clock turns. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio. The facts, the fury, the funny. Don't be stupid. Listen to Air America. It feels like thinking. Hey,
Anyways, here we go. Iraq, let me get this straight, Riley. So the Shia majority looks like it might be a majority. It's right on the fence of being the majority in the assembly, but not quite.
Yes.
We've got coming in second, the Kurds. The Shia and the Kurds are starting to chit-chat. Coming in third is Ayad Alawi's party. And, of
yes.
course, you remember how he campaigned. Who you vote for? Vote for Alawi. Come on. Do it. Alawi. God, what do you vote for? Shias. What? How about that? Alawi. Huh? Okay. So, anyways, but so that worked for him. He came in. He came in third. Perhaps. But what does this all mean? Is this going to be a theocracy light? Or is it going to, you know, are they going to start every assembly meeting with, who hates Israel? Are they going to, you know, how is this going to fold? Are they going to align themselves with the clergy in Iran? I mean, it seems like, you know, boy, the neocon death cult certainly botched this one up, didn't they, Riley?
It looks as though the neocon death cult was outthought in terms of the Iraq elections. Now, we should start out by saying, Mark, that America didn't really want elections in Iraq this early in the first place.
No, we wanted to go there to get the weapons of mass destruction that weren't there, the ones that we were told were there by Shoavi, whose word we took over the CIA, and who turned out to be maybe an Iranian spy, but now looks like he might be the prime minister.
Yes, he may well be. He's lobbying to become the prime minister. But the bottom line is, Ali al-Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the leading Shiite cleric in Iraq.
The Ayatollah of rock and roll?
That's the one. He demanded the elections, and elections they had.
Yeah.
And his the organization that he helped put together, although Hussein Shahristani was the actual organizer of the United Iraqi Alliance. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that got somewhere on the order, depending on who you talk to, between 48% and 51% of the 8 million votes that were actually cast in the Iraqi election. Now, we should say 8 million votes cast, I believe, out of about 14 million eligible, but there were some places where voter turnout was as low, and this is in some Sunni dominated areas, as low as 2%, which could explain why there are no Sunnis that have been directly elected to these seats. Yet, and this is where I think that the American neocons got outthought. These guys are playing this whole thing very close to the vest. They are saying, okay, we want Islamic law, which is to obviously satisfy the people that put them in power. But we don't want a theocracy like the one that they have in Iran.
Yeah.
So that they're playing that so that they don't want to, you know, anger someone to the point that the Americans do something that they're not prepared to deal with.
Allow
this way they got no choice.
Allow it can still win. Please, vote for me. Please. Vote for me. Please.
Well,
Get up and vote for me.
Alawi's party, the Iraqi List, got 40 seats out of the 275-seat National Assembly. By comparison, the United Iraqi Alliance got 140 to 141 seats, and the Kurds got something on the order of 75. That's why you're hearing about the Kurds and the Shia negotiating the possible terms of a joint or a coalition government.
Well, the Kurds are, you know, they want to be as autonomous as possible, so they're going to align themselves with whatever the majority is to guarantee their autonomy, I would imagine.
Yeah, they want to make sure they know that no Iraqi constitution is going to guarantee them independence. But you're right, autonomy, a federal state of Kurdistan is what they're looking for. Now, mind you, the Kurdistan Alliance is actually two different factions of Kurds that have come together. Whenever you have two different political parties coming together, you run the risk that they'll break apart over something.
Well, I remember that when Bob Baer was here, Bob Baer, our CIA guy.
Oh, yeah.
It was great. He was talking about, you know, the idea of the Israelis aligning with the Kurds to possibly stand up against a negative government in light of what Israel expects out of this government. And he said you can't get the Kurds to kill anyone but each other.
See? But now, the Kurdish militia has, in fact, been trained by Israelis. But this is business that they're talking about now. This is the business of running the country. They need a two-thirds majority in order to get anything, certainly to get a constitution drafted through this National Assembly. When you put together the 141 votes of the Shias and the 75 seats of the Kurds, you got a solid two-thirds, you got a three-quarters majority, in fact.
Right, and the Sunnis didn't participate yet are going to be kind of saying, well, you're going to have to deal with us, so where's our peace?
And the Shia have been welcoming. The United Iraqi Alliance has said, we welcome the Sunnis. Have them come on in. We'll sit down. We'll negotiate. They are playing a very, very skilled, clever game here. They are not tipping their hand. And this is typical of Sistani.
Wow. Good, man. I'm glad we got all that taken. I'm Larry. I'm still running. Please. Please. Come on. Come on, both. Get up. Here we go. The liberal agenda for today from the Streisand compound. One, criticized the Gates art installation in Central Park. Couldn't those hundreds of orange banners have been rainbow flags, huh? Come on. A little purpose, a little meaning. Two, new bumper stickers. Dated Dean, married Carrie, divorced Carrie, dating Dean again. Three, for the Westminster Dog Show, protest the designation Best in Show. Suggest they replace with, they're all good dogs. Come on. Why hurt their feelings? Four, praise Kanye West for winning 3 Grammys. Note, find out who Kanye West is, if you could. Okay, here we go. Put this in the conversation. Gee, I'm glad we didn't go through a bloody expensive war just so we could replace Saddam with some militant pro-Iranian Shiites, man. I'm glad we didn't do anything that incredibly stupid. Wake up, sheeple. You drank the Kool-Aid. Please, please.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, that hurts. Coming up tomorrow, are the demands of the modern workplace eroding families? We're going to talk with some folks who know because they wrote a book about it.
Great.
Welcome
nice.
Back, Maren. Good
nice
to have you.
Nice to see you, Riley. Have a good night.
All right, you too. See you tomorrow here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on